This podcast is shared for the purposes of information only. The discussion does not reflect a direct or implied endorsement by Municipal World or its members.
This podcast is brought to you by Enbridge Gas and the Affordable Multifamily Housing Program. Please visit enbridgegas.com/affordable for more information.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in. For Municipal World, I'm Scott Bokey. This is the MW Shares podcast, where we share the stories of communities from coast to coast to coast. These are the stories of local government, the celebrations of success, the sharing of lessons learned, the cautionary tales, and the keen insights into what lies ahead for municipalities.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for another episode of MW Shares. Today I'm being joined by Chris Barrington Lee. Chris is an associate professor at McGill University, joined between its Institute for Health and Social Policy and the Beeler School of Environment. Chris and I are going to be talking about his paper, Trends in Conceptions of Progress and Well-Being, that was part of the recent World Happiness Report, published by Sustainable Development Solutions Network and powered by the Gallup World Poll data. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining me. I'm really interested in happiness, so I'm so glad we could have this discussion. And I think it's turning up more and more in the discussions around local governments and municipalities. But, you know, first of all, before we get into that, how does someone with two PhDs, physics and economics, become involved in researching happiness?
You know, I was doing research physics education and research physics for 12 years, and I was having a great time. I ended up wanting to do something a little more socially relevant. And so I had a couple of year hiatus and then went back and retrained in economics. And so the relevance of that still to, well, of how I got into happiness and into maybe my approach to economics, I think I have a fairly good BS filter in general. And I came into economics, I suppose, with some kind of skepticism. And I also like to think a little bit more of an empirical orientation. Theory is beautiful and useful, but, you know, ultimately it's nice if the things that we believe about the world are accountable to evidence. And, you know, in economics, that's not always experimental evidence, but it's evidence. So now every economist would agree with all of that. But I came in with some particular interests. I came into economics with some particular interests, which you might call macroeconomic and maybe sort of environmental economic. And the problem was that I couldn't address those very well using what I was learning because I had some skepticism about the real fundamentals, the stuff that you do learn or should learn in Econ 101, which really are the two questions: how do people behave and what is good for people? And those two ingredients both could be addressed by looking to other disciplines outside economics for more in-depth answers for the best evidence we have. When I came across the economics of happiness, in which there was a close connection to evidence, and it wasn't simple in the sense that there's no simple answer to what makes people happy. If you are actually measuring happiness directly and then just finding out what it is that explains differences in across people and communities and societies and countries, or changes over time in how good people feel about their life, the answer to that can be complicated. And so maybe that's the right place to start. If the simplifications lead you astray, if a simplified model like economics likes to use about what's good for people leads you astray, then maybe you need to stick to what the evidence says about what's good for people, even if it doesn't allow you to write as pretty and simple theoretical models. So then I got, you know, instead of being able to answer the questions that originally brought me into economics, I kind of got stuck on that first day of Econ 101 in just answering one of those two initial questions for a good chunk of the rest of my career.
Yeah, it's very clear in the paper as well that bent towards, you know, empirical research. And you remark that the desire for new measures of policy success and human thriving is a worldwide phenomenon. and that subjective well-being approach holds growing sway around the world. Was this a surprise to you?
Well, I suppose it wasn't a surprise at the point that I did this work, because there's a whole history to the database that's behind that part of that paper, in which we looked around the world at the ways people are trying to measure progress and well-being, trying to measure something that represents what they think society is about, or what people aspire to, or what government should aspire to in an outcome for policy. And also, of course, because I've been thinking about this for a long time, and so it makes sense to me that people will continue to be drawn to this evidence on happiness. I wouldn't be in the field. None of us would be in the field if not for the fact that when you ask people a question like, taking all things into account, how satisfied are you with your life these days on a scale of 0 to 10? And you translate that into different languages all around the world, and you ask people in all kinds of different cultures, including more collectivist cultures, more individualistic cultures, that you find the same patterns, essentially. So in the sense that you statistically explain differences in people's answer to that question about life overall with other things that you know about their lives. We find, amazingly, and this part was a surprise, in fact, but we find that the same things are explaining happy lives all around the world. So it seems to be tapping into something universal, even though we have different cultures and priorities in culture and maybe aspiration and so on. Well, it turns out that humans all over the world are very social beings. And so a lot of what explains how good people's lives feel to them overall relate to how they interact with each other, and things like trust and close relationships and productive cooperative undertakings. So because of that, it had seemed to me already that the benefits of having, again, an empirically accountable background to any system of measuring progress was going to be increasingly attractive over time.
Yeah, I think that's something that we've all seen, I suppose, as a result of the pandemic, that when people are removed from that social environment, that they do crave that, and that has probably led to less happiness, I suppose, overall. But I want to get into some of the existing approaches that you mentioned in the paper as well to capturing happiness, and three in particular were Bhutan, the United Kingdom, and New Zealand. And they don't actually use the term happiness, but they opt for specific subjective well-being questions instead. Why is this?
Well, I've been a little bit loose in my language so far. Happiness, of course, can mean different things to different people, unless at the beginning of their conversation they define exactly what they're talking about. That's even more so and even more problematic with the word well-being, which both of these terms can be used sometimes as branding, but they can also be used to mean specific things that can be different between people coming from different backgrounds, orientations, or fields. So amongst people studying the economics of happiness or the science of happiness, what often we mean when we say happiness, and especially economists, is actually that life satisfaction question. And so in the categorization of this stuff, this is a subjective well-being question, as you referred to, but it's one amongst a few different classes of subjective well-being. So I would say the most important distinctions are the affective ones. So this is, you can think, maybe a little more related to our limbic system. So how are you feeling at the moment? Mm. Are you smiling and laughing a lot? Are you feeling frustration or anger, or these kind of feelings that we can introspect and give them names, but they are coming from somewhere other than the really cognitive cerebral parts of our brain. And then an evaluative question like, how satisfied are you with your life these days? This is a cognitive evaluation of life, and that's that's the class of subjective well-being question which has become most prominent and is of most interest in thinking about progress and evaluating human lives overall. And I mean, it's for a simple reason. It's this question which leaves absolutely everything up to the individual. So the individual is an expert on one thing, and that is how good does life feel? They're actually not an expert on what possible future changes would make you change your answer the most or make you better off. But only the individual can introspect in this way that mixes their affective states, their emotional states, and whatever it is that's cognitive, it comes from our cerebral cortex, if you like, that relates to our aspirations or our values or the, you know, the kinds of things that we want to happen in life. And so when you ask this amazingly broad question, it allows people to incorporate the whatever mix is correct in terms of those more cognitive and affective parts of our life. So now getting back to your question about what different governments are doing, actually, some governments are using happiness explicitly, and some are more explicitly or increasingly oriented towards subjective well-being as a set of a few measures, as I mentioned. The Bhutanese approach has not particularly privileged subjective well-being. So, you know, it goes often by the name of gross national happiness or something like this. But actually, right, it's got its own specification of what the Bhutanese think is important to a good life. And it's not tied or driven by or accountable to data from subjective well-being in particular. The New Zealand approach is increasingly explicitly related to life satisfaction. In fact, their last budget, literally the first page of their budget document after the title, is an account of how life satisfaction, the average answer to this question that I mentioned, had changed over the previous year. And the UK is certainly got an orientation which is has been one step behind the scenes, closely tied to the science based on the life satisfaction question. And actually, you know, often these governments, when they are going down that road and really tying it to the quantitative science of explaining life satisfaction, they avoid the word happiness because it still makes people giggle a little bit when you talk about happiness. And it may sound like something a little more superficial or transitory than the cognitive life evaluation. But once you've said, well, by happiness, you know, we really mean this life evaluation and we're referring to this quantitative science, then it's okay. And in their latest documents, the UK Treasury has actually started being comfortable referring to it as happiness as well.
My understanding is that people determine happiness comparatively, meaning that people in more equitable societies are generally happier in those places that have a lot of inequality. So this also applies between groups within a society. So I was struck by your argument that we would be better served by using distributions of individual outcomes as distributions rather than the awkward statistics of means and scalar inequality metrics. So how would this help provide a deeper understanding?
For your mathematically inclined listeners, I have to quibble a little bit. It's subtle, but it's not the case that a society with greater inequality should necessarily be less happy if people's happiness is comparatively determined. But there's a bunch to unpack there. First of all, when we say inequality, we're often referring to income inequality. Mm-hmm. It's very important to remember that's actually a relatively small part of our life. And one of the huge lessons of the life satisfaction literature is how small it is, right? So in many contexts, your income or your material consumption or your material and non-material service consumption and your wealth, those things are all important for life satisfaction. Not as important as other things that are to do with your social context and how you relate to people around you. And so when we talk about inequality, it's important to realize that, okay, what inequality in what and what are we focusing on? Now, just let's think about the math very briefly here. Okay, so when you said that happiness is determined comparatively, that's actually not true for most aspects of our life in the sense that if I'm around people who have lots of friends, that doesn't make me less happy. Having lots of friends is great for me, but it's also great for other people around me. What you, I think, are referring to, though, is that there's a bunch of evidence that shows if I'm around other people who are consuming more, and it's of the visible, conspicuous kind of consumption, I'm actually less happy. I then require more consumption to be, you know, as happy as I would be if those standards that are set around me were lower. So that is remarkable. It has enormous implications for the way economists count welfare and what we think about what happens when GDP per capita goes up, everyone's consuming more. It's actually the case that maybe no one's better off, because if everybody goes up the same and people are comparing, then no one's actually. But with this asymmetry, imagine that the spread of income is greater, but all that matters is how you compare yourself to others. It's, again, you could increase the spread, but let's say that your happiness around income just depended on your rank, your position. And if you change the spread, or indeed if you shift everyone up or down, that doesn't change the distribution of ranks at all. If you're in a society in which incomes are quite close and people psychologically benefit from their rank in income, then it means that by putting a little bit of more emphasis of your time, a little bit more effort into increasing your income, you can change your rank a lot, right? If incomes start out close, then it's easier to change your position. Now, in this world in which rank is all that matters for income, benefits, happiness, as I said, if you change people's position and sort them around, you still have everyone ranked from, you know, the first percentile to the 100th percentile. And so you're not going to change average well-being, no matter what happens. But in that world in which incomes start out close, people are going to put more of their time and energy into that rat race, into trying to increase their income standing or consumption standing, than they would if they were far apart, and putting a bit of energy isn't going to change their rank. Putting a bit of effort into increasing income isn't going to change their rank. And so in fact, you can have, so where is that time and energy coming from? If people are oriented towards income or the market or consumption, it's coming from the other places, which also matter from happiness. If you have a society that's more oriented towards conspicuous consumption and market income, that means they're putting less time into family, community, and pro-social activities, which it turns out are huge supports for overall life evaluations. And so I've just described a simple model of the world in which less inequality, the society less happy. So maybe that sounds weird, but the bigger picture here is, first of all, income is not everything. There are ways to improve society's outcome and well-being by putting more emphasis on these other things that relate to our deeply social nature. The bigger picture is to think about how much emphasis we're putting on that side of life, on the conspicuous consumption, on the maybe more superficial judgment of people based on how they look in terms of their income. Right. And so societies also differ in that. Right. So instead of thinking about inequality varying, I like to think about the emphasis on market performance in how we judge people. So here's the thought experiment. If you were to meet a stranger on the street, are the first thoughts that are coming into your mind, does this person represent a threat, either because they're poor and dangerous, or because they are richer than me and looking and judging me? Or is the first thing that comes to your mind, here's a fellow human being, I have something in common with this person? Now, those are difficult things to measure, but I've tried to measure them just by looking at the degree to which your position in the income distribution matters for explaining life satisfaction within your country. The strength of that link does predict overall life satisfaction. So in other words, countries are happier where your income rank is less important. We could call this a materialistic orientation, right? So how much are people focused on market performance in judging each other and themselves?
Right. And it's so refreshing to hear the evolution of the thinking around economics. And I think for local decision makers, we probably have been overly focused on that material conception of well-being and happiness. You also mentioned in the paper, the efforts which are likely to endure involve some deep form of accountability to democratic process or to empirical evidence when specifying the weights or constituents in indicator systems. Can you unpack that a little for me?
Yeah, it really comes back again to the idea of accountability, empirical accountability that I mentioned at the beginning, and also to the idea that that of branding, I suppose. So if you look at the various well-being frameworks, well-being measurement efforts, metrics around the world, some of them use happiness or well-being really as little more than a way to brand some other agenda, some other set of agenda. Like, I mean, that's not a pejorative term, a platform, a set of policies that one is advocating for. If you would like to have a framework that government is using for planning and for policy evaluation and for budgeting and so on, that is going to last the test of time and, of course, the test of political cycles, then it's good to have something that is more, that has got some transparency and some maybe democratic credibility, so that it, you know, it doesn't be seen as partisan. It's not seen as, so this, you know, there's got to be some substance to the use of words like happiness. And right. So where can you get that substance from? So I suggested there's two ways. If you want to build up a measurement scheme for progress or well-being, one way would be to really go to the data and tie your measurement priorities to what the data say. So for instance, I think education is important. I think health is important. And I want to have some way to give an emphasis or a weight or a share of resources to those things. What is it going to be? So one way would be to look at what is the statistical evidence from people doing research on how good life is overall, and let that ongoing, never finished scientific effort inform the relative weights on the relative importance of other objective outcomes that policy can target. Another way to have accountability to a set of measurement priorities would be to have it be democratic. And so in this case, it could diverge from what the science says, what the stats says. But if you go around and hold you know, workshops, town halls around the country and say, hey, what do you think is important for life in our society? Or in your municipality or community, then that's something else which should transcend political cycles. Those are two ways you could proceed. You know, the UK kind of did the latter one by having a year of consultation about what well-being means. My country, Canada, has been through in the last 2 years a process which is more tied to the empirical accountability.
Right.
Anyway, if you don't have that kind of accountability, it just seems to me that you're going to, it's just going to go by the wayside. And the database that we built up shows that this is what happens. A lot of these measures, they come in and they just don't last.
Right. Well, the good news, I guess, for local governments is they're well used to doing that, reaching out to the public and road testing their policies. So that kind of leads to my last question. You know, a lot of the discussion has been around national governments, but what advice would you have for local governments, municipalities that are interested in measuring and promoting happiness measures?
There's a common misconception instinct that I've noticed in talking to local governments about measuring well-being or instituting a new well-being framework. And that is that they tend to assume an important starting point is to start measuring it. I mean, that's a very natural inclination, right? If I want to know what is good for people in my community, I surely need to start implementing some new expensive survey or something to measure happiness, measure life satisfaction, and then I can start to see whether it's gone up or down and maybe start to figure out why. There's a problem with that. Not only is it very expensive, you know, for many cities, they rely a lot on the National Statistical Agency for that kind of statistic. But right. Unfortunately, you're not going to have enough data to make a lot of inference about your own city. Now, there are reasons still to have a local survey and have people engaged and as part of a communication effort and so on. But ultimately, if you want to have a decision-making tool, you're going to have to appeal to the broader evidence from the whole field. In other words, while you may only have 10,000 or a million answers to the question from your own municipality, if you make use of the evidence from around the world, then there's tens of millions of respondents, some of them tracked over time, who've been telling about how their life feels, and we can, you know, disentangle why. And so, so what does that mean for Citi? It means that you may need to do the evidence-based or empirical accountability approach to your metric rather than the democratic accountability method. In other words, you know, make use of everything we've learned over four decades in this field, and you can complement that with local information gathering and evidence, and certainly, to the extent possible, program evaluation that incorporates overall life evaluations. But the not obvious thing is to plug into the evidence base. And a great place for any local community or municipality to start there, at the moment, I think worldwide leader is unquestionably the UK What Works Centre for Wellbeing. And they provide, they synthesize this evidence and provide all kinds of summaries and communication strategies and decision-making strategies based on this evidence for local governments. In fact, as well as central governments, and as well as even organization environments, business environments. So they are currently the leading knowledge mobilization NGO in this space.
Well, that's a great reference. I'm definitely going to look into that after this discussion. Chris, this has been fascinating. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk with us today.
My great pleasure. Thanks a lot.
The paper is titled Trends and Conceptions of Progress and Well-Being and can be downloaded at worldhappiness.report. Thanks to all of you for listening. On behalf of Municipal World, I wish you peace and purpose.
We'd like to hear your ideas. If you have a topic that you would like to see covered in a future episode, simply drop us an email at stories@municipalworld.com. Also, don't forget to share and subscribe.